ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। तितिक्षत्यक्रमं वाण्या उपार्याक्रमतामपि भूतानं करुणाशश्वद् अर्थानां शतिवृत्तमान्। तितिक्षत्यक्रमं वाण्या उपार्याक्रमतामपि भूतानं करुणाशश्वद् अर्थानां शतिवृत्तमान्। तितिक्षत्यक्रमं वाण्या उपार्याक्रमतामपि भूतानां करुणाशश्वद् अर्थानां शतिवृत्तमान्। Vaishnavis, tikshatya karmam vainyam aparya kramatam api tyanam karana shashvad. Tikshati tolerates akramam offense. Vainya, the son of King Vena, upari on his head, akramatam of those who are trampling, api also bhutanam to all living entities, karuna very kind-hearted, shashvat always, artanam to the aggrieved, shativritiman accepting the profession of the earth. Profession, well, that's what it says. Translation purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. This King Prithu will be very, very kind to all citizens. Even though a poor person may trample over the king's head by violating the rules and regulations, The king, out of his causeless mercy, will be forgetful and forgiving. As a protector of the world, he will be as tolerant as the earth itself. Srila Prabhupada's purport. King Prithu is herein compared to the earthly planet as far as his tolerance is concerned. Although the earth is always trampled upon by men and animals, it still gives food to them by producing grains, fruits, and vegetables. As an ideal king, Maharaj Prithu is compared to the earthly planet, for even though some citizens might violate the rules and regulations of the state, he would still be tolerant and maintain them with fruits and grains. In other words, it is the duty of the king to look after the comforts of the citizens, even at the cost of his own personal inconvenience. This is not the case, however, in Kali Yuga. For in Kali Yuga, the kings and heads of state enjoy life at the cost of taxes exacted from the citizens. Such unfair taxation makes the people dishonest, and the people try to hide their income in so many ways. Eventually, the state will not be able to collect taxes and consequently will not be able to meet its huge military and administrative expenses. Everything will collapse, and there will be chaos and disturbance all over the state. Om Gyana Timanandisha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshurun Mitamina Tasma Sri Gurvenamaha Vanchiko Patrubhischa Kripa Sindhu Bhyabhicha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So we're not going to talk about taxation policy today. That's actually mentioned in one of the verses before or after, so Prabhupada's kind of continuing that theme. But obviously the main theme here is the personal characteristics and qualities of a leader. And here we see Maharaj Prithu as an ideal leader. Obviously, he's an empowered incarnation of Krishna, and so he exhibits in full this, or maybe not in full, but he exhibits very, very completely for our benefit what sort of qualities should be there in the ruler, what sort of attitudes they should have towards those that are under them. And of course, the main thing that has been mentioned here is that first and foremost, a king, a ruler, or any leader considers himself as servant. And his position is to serve those that he leads. Of course, that is the constitutional position of all living entities. We are all servant. And in this material world, most people don't want to be servant. They want to be master. We've come to this material world out of our desire to control, to take Krishna's place. And our first contact when we enter this material atmosphere, at first intersection, is false ego, ahankara. So, in other words, to be able to be in this material world, to be in a material body, to be separate from Krishna, means that we have to first forget our identity as pure servant of God and take on the identity of this body and mind, the gross and subtle bodies. That's required. So everyone is in this position in the material world. But the devotee knows that our purpose is to reestablish our relationship of love and service to the Supreme. So we get out of this material world and the suffering in this material world by understanding that we are not master, that we are servant. So we begin from that point, from that perspective. And there are so many verses in the Bhagavatam that corroborate this. In 6.11.25, this is a nice verse. It says, O my Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, will I be able to be a servant of your eternal servants who find shelter only at your lotus feet? O Lord of my life, may I again become their servant so that my mind may always think of your transcendental attributes, my words always glorify those attributes, and my body always engage in your loving service of your Lordship. Anyone know who spoke this? 6.11? 6th Canto, 11th chapter, this is Vritrasura, the demon, who was not really a demon, who was a great devotee. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, this verse gives the sum and substance of devotional life. One must first become a servant of the servant of the servant of the Lord, Das Anudas. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advised, and he showed by his own example, that a living entity should always desire to be the servant of the servant of the servant, the maintainer of the gopis, gopi bhartu parakamalayor das and das anudas, Majalila 13:80. So, how does this apply to a king? or a leader, a ruler, who often must exhibit other qualities other than this great humility and service attitude. Because a king like Prithu is established actually by Krishna and given great power and responsibility, that's there. But at the same time, he must act according to the same principles of service and humility. In other words, the ruler, the leader, is no different than any other devotee, any other living entity, who must take this humble service attitude in order to make spiritual advancement and get out of the clutches of this material energy. So this theme is there in several places in the Bhagavatam. And the Bhagavatam can give us so many lessons, not just in, well, obviously in spiritual life, but how we apply spiritual life to such things as leadership and even to politics. Because so many lessons are there. A very similar lesson is given in the Bhagavatam in the 5th canto, 12th chapter, which is the story of Jada Bharat. And in this chapter, he's giving instruction to the king, Rahugana. As you remember, he was sort of in an avaduta position. He was just laying there as kind of a dumb person who couldn't speak, who couldn't, you know. So they said, okay, grab this guy. We need another carrier for the palanquin. Is it palanquin or palanquin? Palanquin, right? Anyway, which Maharaj Rahugana was riding in. Now, Maharaj Rahugana was not a bad king. He had many good qualities, but he lacked a little humility. So Jada Bharat instructed him. In verse 8, it says, King Rahugana was proud. Oh, I'm sorry, this is the purport. Srila Prabhupada says, King Rahugana was proud of being the king, and he felt he had the right to control the citizens as he liked. But actually, he was engaging men in carrying his palanquin without payment, and therefore he was causing them trouble without reason. Nonetheless, the king was thinking that he was the protector of the citizens. Actually, the king should be the representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For this reason, he is called Naradevata, the Lord among human beings. So, establishing this very important position, the king. Now comes the however. However, when a king thinks that because he is the head of the state, he can utilize the citizens for his own sense gratification, he is in error. Learned circles do not appreciate the king's utilizing public endeavor for his own benefit. His duty is to give protection to the citizens instead. The king should not become such a rogue that he exploits the citizens for his own benefit. So this is the issue. The king, the ruler, the leader can have a degree of power, can have a degree of control. But as soon as that power and control is conceived of as for oneself, when one utilizes the facility that is given to one by one's karma, by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for whatever aspect that one receives that, when one thinks that that is for oneself, for one's own gratification, and not in the interest of service, as Prabhupada said, he is making a very great error. And therefore it becomes unqualified for that position of leadership. So we have this lesson of the Bhagavatam, several places, talking about rulers and kings and how they should act properly. What is the code of conduct? What should be their attitude? What should be their service attitude? So these lessons aren't just, we don't have too many kings and rulers, and we do, they're either ceremonial or they're, you know, great, they're dictators or tyrants. So those aren't exactly the examples we follow. So how do we apply this? What does this mean to us? We could see, I think, that most of us, if not all of us, are leaders in our own lives. Leader doesn't just mean someone who's the temple president or somebody who's this or that or whatever. I mean, obviously, temple leaders, managers, they have leadership, responsibility. But what about parents? Parents are leaders, aren't they? And their family, of their children. Grave responsibility to take care of one's children and raise them in Krishna consciousness. So that's leadership. What about every devotee? Anyone who has spiritual knowledge is a leader, because the large majority of our population does not have spiritual knowledge. They're bereft of having understanding of the relationship with Krishna. You all do. The devotees have that knowledge. Therefore, and of course, you are the natural leaders. And of course, Brahmins are designated as the spiritual leader for all people within the Varnashram system. So whether you're a Brahmin or not, if you're a Vaishnav, which is higher than a Brahmin, if you have spiritual knowledge, you have a responsibility of leadership to everyone, to those who do not have it. So I think when we talk about these lessons of leadership, I'm not talking to a small segment of some audience of GBCs or temple presidents or whatever, but actually to all devotees. We all should see how we are leaders and become leaders, become even, develop our leadership even more. So, and of course, this is also confirmed many places. Obviously, the lessons of Rishabhdev are there in the fifth canto. I mean, no one should become a parent, a guru, a king, at any position, unless one is able to do what? What one must do to be a leader? Deliver to the dependents from the cycle of birth and death. Thank you, exactly. And we also hear from, in the fifth canto, chapter 12:8, this is a continuation of the purport by Prabhupada that we read earlier. He says, actually, the supreme proprietor of everything is Lord Vishnu. He is the maintainer of everyone. The king, the father, the guardian are simply representatives of Lord Vishnu, empowered by him to look after the management and maintain things. So Prabhupada is very clear. You have any position, whether you're a parent, whether you're a temple leader, whatever you are, this is empowered. This is an empowered position by the Lord for the devotee. It's empowered, and he simply is supposed to look after things, maintain things on behalf of Krishna, on behalf of the Lord. So I was looking a little bit into, actually I developed this some years ago. I was working on this idea of leadership and what some of the modern ideas of leadership are with modern management and things like this. And one idea that really struck me was this idea of what's called servant leadership, which is exactly what we've been hearing about. This was exactly what Jada Bharat was speaking about, exactly what Vichasur, all of these great devotees, Prithu Maharaj exemplified this idea of servant leadership. This is a concept. Of course, an old concept, but it was articulated more in the modern world by a management consultant called Robert Greenleaf. And he's written books and has, different programs about this idea of servant leadership. And Robert Greenleaf defined this. He said, the servant leader is servant first. Remember, you can take knowledge from anywhere, right? Take gold from a dirty place. So anyway, we'll hear Robert Greenleaf says, the servant leader is servant first. It all begins with a natural feeling that one wants to serve first. Then conscious choice brings one to aspire to lead. The difference manifests itself in the care taken by the servant, first to make sure that other people's highest priority needs are served. Sounds like a devotee, doesn't he? He had a strong Christian. He was actually a Quaker, like that. So anyway, now I wanted to take this a little further. And some of this information, I want to give proper attribution, comes from Akura Prabhu. Some of you may know him. He was from Europe, and he's done a lot of coaching and, leadership coaching. He's a consultant. And he studied this a lot, and he developed a lot of ideas based upon Greenleaf. So some of this is kind of the Krishnaized version of it, where the concepts come there, but the application to devotees was done. Well, some of it is my thinking, but a lot of it is Akura Prabhu's. So, giving proper. And so Akura said, servant leaders are devotees who have taken up the responsibility to personally take care of a group of serious candidates for the advancement in devotional service. They are leader servants, the concept that is becoming more and more prominent in business sector today. They are facilitators. They recognize talent and potential of devotees, and they help them express and engage them. They are friendly and unselfish. They like to see others advance. They like to assist others in becoming servant leaders. Isn't this the kind of leader that we all want, that we like, that we appreciate? Someone who is interested in our advancement, interested in our issues, wants us to become more successful in our service. That's good leadership. There's a list of six qualities and actions of a servant leader, and again, Akura's Krishnanized these a little bit. So this is what a servant leader does. They devote themselves to serving the needs of the devotee community. They focus on meeting the needs of those they lead. They develop devotees to bring out their best spiritual qualities and service. They coach, guide, and mentor others and encourage their self-expression in their service. They facilitate personal and spiritual growth in all who serve them. They listen and build a sense of community of devotees. It's quite a list, isn't it? It's a little bit overwhelming. You know, are we able to come up to these kind of standards? But I think that it's important that even if we think, well, this may be something difficult to obtain, you know, that we hear it, just like we continually hear in the Bhagavatam the qualities of a pure devotee, right? We hear everyone in the Srimad Bhagavatam is basically a pure devotee, or they become one, right? Guys, Margari the hunter, you know, he's, you know, not only killing but torturing animals, lowest of the low. And then, you know, meets Narada Muni, becomes a pure devotee. So Kali Yuga is a little more difficult. It seems like, you know, it's not like this instant transformation. It seems like it takes us a little time in Kali Yuga, you know, to come from the platform that we begin with, you know, to a more advanced and mature stage of Krishna consciousness, what to speak of becoming a complete pure devotee, one without any self-motivation or self-interest. But nevertheless, when we hear these things, it gives us something to obtain to, something to aspire to, and understand at least what is the goal, and so to what degree can we maybe imbibe some of these things or understand some of these qualities in our life. I'm also going to read one more list. And again, I think this is a whole seminar, you know, for a day covering these things, so we're going to just do a quick reading through. But these are 10 characteristics of how a servant leader leads others. So these are, of course, these are management principles, but they're also devotional principles, I think. First is listening. Active listening is active as an act of will and commitment. So, in other words, listening is something that we have to commit, is something that we have to decide to do. It's somewhat voluntary. It's not that listening, you know, Anuttama Prabhu teaches about listening in communication course, and we've taught it in other courses, and we teach it in the Grihastha course. And oh, okay. And not only that, but Anuttama Prabhu tomorrow morning is going to talk specifically about listening. So we won't go into it too far. We'll understand the importance of it in our next core class. So listening is there, and for a leader. Empathy is the next one. Are you covering that? Probably covering empathic listening a little bit. Okay, that may be covered too. But it means to identify with the concerns of others to better understand and lead. You know, you have to be able to look beyond just, this is what I want, and this person is not doing it, or this person is impeding what I want. We also have to look at that person. What are their needs, desires, interests? All right, probably talking about that too. You know, what is it that we need to understand about their situation? And good leaders do that. They have some, you know, it's a little bit of psychology. It's a little bit of understanding people, what they're motivated by. And, you know, if you don't really understand it, there's one real good way to find out. You ask them, going back to listening. You ask them, and you find out about them first. And often, if you first do this, then whatever you have to do as a leader, whatever action you have to take, becomes more palatable, often. Okay. A third quality is called healing. Taking opportunities to restore others to wholeness, to show caring. And that can be done. I've had two or three situations where I've had to, as a leader, remove somebody from their service, like fire them. You know, so you can do it like Donald Trump, you know, throw one person after another of his administration out of the office, out on the street, or you can do it in a more healing way. And a couple of devotees I've fired are some of my best friends now. You know, it's about how you do it. It's about the qualities that you exhibit and the care that you show towards people in a difficult situation. And often they may not like the result, they may appreciate your attitude and your sincerity in how you had to do a difficult job. Yeah, because devotees are also understanding and kind. And forgiving. The next one is awareness, an ability to see things as they really are, awareness of self and situation. Now that's an interesting one, isn't it? We don't not only have to be aware of others, but we have to be aware of ourself, aware of our own motivations, our own anarthas, our own failings, our own preconceptions or prejudices. You know, and I see that, you know, sometimes I'll go into a management situation, you know, with a certain mindset, and I find that there's a time when you kind of got to step back a little bit, be a little more aware of what's going on, and sort of put aside some of the preconceptions you had there, and try to look at things with a more open perspective. Another quality is persuasion. To seek to convince, not to pull rank, but to go ahead and show the way. Didn't Srila Prabhupada bring us to Krishna consciousness through persuasion? Right? I mean, he convinced us of the philosophy, you know, by his personal qualities, of course, and he was acharya, you know, that he showed by example, but also he persuaded us. You know, the philosophy is written convincingly, you know, and you hear his lectures. He's always trying to convince his audience of Krishna and devotional service, you know, but he did it in such a way that we wanted to be persuaded. We wanted to agree almost, you know, and come to Krishna. So persuasion doesn't mean beating somebody over the head. I had a GBC once in my early days, actually with Rupanuga Prabhu, and he said, one of the problems we have as devotees is we tend to bludgeon each other with the philosophy. So that's not what's meant by persuasion. You know, that we beat each other up, you know, by philosophy, how much you're in Maya and why you're in Maya and that kind of thing. You know, but rather through encouragement. Next idea here is conceptualization. Look at a problem with the mission of the organization. Think beyond day-to-day concerns to place in context projects that are part of a larger vision. So we all need to have larger vision. Nobody had greater vision than Srila Prabhupada. And, you know, and the stories are legendary. You know, when he had one little storefront temple, he had his business card said, what, temples all over the world? That's vision. He never lost track of the big vision, making the world Krishna conscious, bringing Krishna consciousness to, you know, 100 countries or whatever, 100 different temples. He would say things like, we have books, we have temples, we are doing, you know, that he had a vision even when he had nothing. So that's our example. You know, the leader thinks of the future, thinks of the vision, conceptualizes the big issues in the organization. And so sometimes, you know, devotees, you know, sometimes it's asked, well, are the average devotees really interested in the big picture and the big strategy and plan? I say they are. I find that devotees really appreciate kind of knowing what's going on, right? You know, what's happening, what, you know, what's the GBC up to? Sometimes it's hard for us to explain what we're up to because we have a sort of fuzzy idea ourselves, but, you know, but we're working on it. You know, so I think it's important that we all, you know, try to really look at what is this Krishna conscious movement about and how do I fit into it? It can be a very small part, but no part is small. You know, we have the example of the sparrow, right, in Ram Lila. Was it a sparrow? Who was taking little bits of, I have the right story here? It's just, what? That's some kind of bird, right? Hmm? There's a squirrel and a spider, but I thought there was a bird involved too somewhere. Anyway, putting the little pebbles in to build a bridge to Lanka, so maybe it was a squirrel or a spider or something else, we're not sure. But at any rate, and of course, he was laughed at by the huge, strong monkey warriors. And Ramachandra said, no, his service is just as important because his attitude, the devotion was equal. So that's what we're looking for. Not some big, big thing that I'm doing this, I'm doing that, but what is your devotion? You know, are you seeing an issue, seeing a problem, seeing something that needs to be done and taking it up? We had this example yesterday in our meetings that young woman in Alachua now, Palika, she just took it upon herself to do some project. It's called Flourish. which is to sort of match young devotees with more older devotees for networking, mentoring, and, you know, helping them to connect to get, you know, to get our next generation, you know, some help, you know, by those who might have contacts, those who might be to help them in professions or whatever. And so, you know, we didn't ask, no one asked her to do this. She took it up. She saw a need and she took it up. You know, whatever happens with it, I mean, the effort is certainly applaudable. Whatever. So that's there. Next one is foresight. View the likely outcome of a given situation based on past lessons, realities of the present, and consequences of the future. That just means you're looking at things carefully, looking at what has happened and how this might project into the future. Again, I think it's part of insight and conceptualization as well. Number eight is stewardship. So this is best used and highest level of care of what has been placed in your trust. So this goes back to some of the purports we read and the verses from the Bhagavatam, that everything is put into our care by Krishna. And of course, we can extend that and say by our guru. So Krishna and guru are giving us certain facilities. Certain things are put into our care, whether it's a temple, whether it's our child, whether it's, you know, three people that work for me, whatever it is, whether it's my husband, whether it's my wife, whatever it may be, we have stewardship. And stewardship doesn't mean that we have overlordship or control. You know, it's not a control concept. It's a concept of someone or something is put into my care by Krishna. This is Krishna's energy. These are Krishna's devotees, you know, and I need to properly care for them on behalf of the Lord. One thing, Chris, I teach, my wife and I teach a lot of Grihastha courses and seminars, and one of the, there's so many themes, but one theme that I find often comes up and I like to talk about is, you know, when you're married and you have a husband or you have a wife, we sometimes forget that husband and wife are Vaishnavis, right? It's not just, oh, that's my wife, that's my husband, you know. They're Vaishnavas. So we have to extend that idea of stewardship, that idea that, you know, this is someone that I am meant to care for, that Krishna has put in as part of, this is my service. But not only this is just my service, but this is my service to a devotee, right? So we have to have that attitude, you know. And it can extend also to brahmacharis or to anyone, you know, the other brahmacharis you're living with. You know, these are people, these are devotees to care for. Krishna has put me with these other devotees to serve. Right? We serve each other. Okay. Commitment to the growth of others, nurture personal, professional, spiritual growth of others, believing in intrinsic value of individuals. Some devotees feel they're at a dead end, you know, or they're not going anywhere in their service. And what happens when devotees feel they're not going anywhere in their service and not inspired? They leave eventually, right? They go out and get a job, or they move to somewhere else, or whatever. So we need to be continually inspiring growth in others. You know, and this is something we talk about a lot. I mean, the succession committee, along with Anuttama Prabhu and others, and one of the things we talk about is career paths. You know, or we could say service paths. In other words, where are you going? What's your next move? Especially for younger people, what is your next move? What are you envisioning for the future? And this is all things that good leadership tries to develop. You know, the sense of succession planning, of, you know, of personal and spiritual growth in the devotees. Another important, my last one here, was building community. Promote opportunities for working together while respecting the dignity of individuals to provide service to the world. This idea of community is very important. Every one of our temples has a community, right? I mean, there's some temples that some devotees live in the temple, but most of the devotees live outside temples now. The vast majority, some of our temples, you've got 12 or 8 devotees that live in the temple, kind of take care of things, take care of the deities, do some of the basic preaching. You know, some of these absolutely essential, critical roles, and we thank those devotees who are still continuing that service. But there may be 500 devotees in a congregation, right, that live outside. And often they're initiated devotees, or sincere devotees, or aspiring devotees, you know, whatever stripe or shape or form. There's so many devotees that are part of our community. And, you know, we can talk about congregation, but I like to use the word community also, because congregation sort of implies people just come for the Sunday feast and go away or something. But we also have communities. That means people who are really part of the association, the sangha of our devotees. I live in Alachua, where we have about 1,100 devotees, and we always think of that as our community, because they're not people, these are people who may have been around for years, or we have like 300 Prabhupada disciples, it's a community. And so you have to sort of respect that community and figure out how you can work with that community with respect and dignity, as is said here, and how to help. The leader needs to always be thinking about how to engage a whole community, and perhaps it's not how, they kind of know how to engage often in spiritual life, but what the leader has to do is provide the opportunity, the facility, the encouragement for it to happen. A lot of times with senior devotees in our congregation, it's not we have to preach to them about why they should do devotional service. It's more we need to provide opportunities for them to do more devotional service. And we have some wonderful examples right in this room, like Vaisheshika. How many people in your congregation is almost all householders, working people, right?
Mostly.
Right. And so you have all of this congregation, they work in the computer industries or whatever there in Silicon Valley, and how many of them participate in some form of preaching or book distribution?
All of them.
All of them. Like, are we talking
everybody.
About 100, right. 200 people?
Altogether, how many people we have? Yeah. Maybe altogether we have about 350.
And they all participate?
Yes.
So this is, of course, an amazing example. This is kind of like, this should be like our flagship, community involvement example, where you have, a community, a congregation of 300 devotees, and they're all doing book distribution. They're all going out and preaching. They're all involved in the mission. That's leadership, of building community. And I suspect if we spoke to someone like Vaisheshika or others who are doing this, I think we would probably find there are many other residual benefits besides books being going out in terms of the community, working together, coming together, having a common purpose, making spiritual advancement, feeling part of Srila Prabhupada's mission, right? So this is all part of leadership, to bring the community together, to help engage them, to be part of this mission. Because when we're part of Srila Prabhupada's mission of preaching and bringing people to Krishna consciousness, there's really, I think I can say this. I'd say there's no greater happiness than that, right? And when we engage in it, even if it's only occasionally for someone like me, it's so rewarding, it's so fulfilling, I just have to say, of everything I do and everywhere I travel, I go to India twice a year, my highlight for this year, the thing where I was the most happy, was going to a Ratha Yatra in Daytona Beach, and I just asked the devotees, can I do the book table for a while? And of course, they couldn't really refuse me, so they said, okay, sure. And for some reason, it was one of those where it was an exceptionally nice crowd and a lot of yoga people. That's all it was. I just had a really great audience, and I was there for an hour, and, I distributed about 20 books and collected $100-some, and, it was amazing. Now I have also gone. I did a book table at our 4th of July in a celebration in Alachua, and the audience is entirely North Florida rednecks. I hate to say it, to be on the bodily conception, but it's like couldn't do anything. So it's not like it's not like I'm especially empowered or anything. Sometimes Krishna you just can't do anything practically. I finally resorted to just handing out cookies. At least give them prasadam. I couldn't get them to take a book even, or anything. But this time, somehow I got a different audience that were receptive. And as I said, and it was just so blissful. So, we need to engage our communities, our devotees in Krishna consciousness, and we just provide them. In that case, it was actually the devotees provided me the opportunity. I didn't arrange that. Other devotees arranged that, and I was able to take advantage. That. So, these qualities that we're talking about certainly apply to devotees. Advanced devotee qualities are very similar to this, because when one becomes advanced, one transcends the false ego. Right? That's almost a definition of spiritual advancement, because what does a false ego mean? I'm this body, I'm this mind. If we're able to transcend that, it's almost like then, what is the result? If we're not our body or mind, we're pure spirit, soul, eternal servant of Krishna, in a loving devotional relationship with him. So, transcending the false ego means, again, knowing that all of our facility, all of our possessions, anything that I have any control over is meant for the service of Krishna. And the devotee has that attitude of service, sort of in general, but also specifically applied to the devotees. Because Krishna himself talks about the importance of service to the devotees. Krishna says to Arjuna in the Adi Purana, "My dear Partha, one who claims to be my devotee is not so. Only a person who claims to be the devotee of my devotee is actually my devotee." So Krishna is saying specifically, service to the devotee is even higher than service to me personally. Right? And so that's our understanding. You know, that's why our service always goes through Guru. You know, but not just Guru, not just doesn't mean you only just serve your Guru and nobody else. We serve all the devotees when we have that opportunity. So, of course, the pure devotee of the Lord is the best example, who's exemplified this. And it's fairly famous, well-known Vyaspuja address by Srila Prabhupada, where he was talking about his guru, Dave Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj. And Prabhupada said, at one part in that lecture he gave, showing his humility, Prabhupada said, "Anyway, it is by his grace, his guru, that I was forced to give up my family life, and he brought me somewhere or other in preaching his gospel. So this is a memorable day. What he desired, I am trying a little bit, and you are all helping me, so I have to thank you more. You are actually representative of my Guru Maharaj, because you are helping me in executing the order of my Guru Maharaj. Thank you very much." So this is the extreme humility that the pure devotee, he's actually saying that his disciples are representatives of his Guru. This is how the advanced devotee is thinking. I'm everyone's servant. And of course, what is Srila Prabhupada's service? His service is to act as Guru and to instruct us. So when Srila Prabhupada is instructing us, he's coming from the platform of, I am the lowly servant of Krishna, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and my Guru Maharaj, and I simply am doing this service on their behalf. Servant leader. Going back to our theme of what is a servant leader, Srila Prabhupada exemplifies this in fullness. So I was thinking about some of the qualities or characteristics of what makes leadership effective. And these are my own thoughts. I can't claim any evidence for this. But I thought, well, three things I thought of, and you could probably think of more. First is the spiritual character of the leader. He has to exhibit spiritual character. And some of the things we're talking about, servant leadership, apply to that. And we learn that from the Bhagavatam, from Srila Prabhupada. And, you know, we may even learn a few things from some leadership training or some thoughts about listening and communication, like we'll hear tomorrow. You know, there's ways that we can develop our character more as leaders. Secondly, an effective leader is able to transmit and bring out that spiritual character in others. So, in other words, we're not Babaji's. We don't become advanced devotees and, you know, go to Radhakund and stay there. I mean, we can, of course, but that wasn't Srila Prabhupada's mood, and it's not our mission. Our mission is to help others, to give others Krishna consciousness. So we also want to, with the devotees who have already made some commitment to Krishna consciousness, as leaders we want to be able to bring out the best in them, to help to whatever degree we can. And I think another important factor is to establish a spiritual culture for those where we interact. So this idea of culture, I think, is very important. We have a spiritual philosophy. that Srila Prabhupada has given us through his books. That philosophy leads to spiritual practice through our sadhana and our service. That spiritual practice then leads to the creation or development of spiritual culture. So Srila Prabhupada often emphasized the need for spiritual culture. In fact, he said, we will make the world Krishna conscious by cultural conquest. Right? He said that at one point. So culture means more than just, you know, art or dance or music, things like that. We also have this idea of varnashram, which is a structure that we have. But I think Vaishnava culture is something a little more than varnashram, because it's based upon the quality of bhakti. So we're talking about Vaishnava culture based on bhakti. But it isn't something theoretical that we sit here and chant Hare Krishna, you know, feeling very cultured. No. It's very active. It's very much part of the world. And I would say that in ISKCON, or the Krishna Consciousness Movement, we haven't really developed strong spiritual culture yet. It's a process. We're 50 years at it. And, you know, some, you know, religions have had a couple thousand years to do it. So we're in the beginning phases. It's beginning. We see elements of it, but we're not fully there yet. But it's something to think about, is how to develop spiritual culture. Because it entails not just art or music or something like that, as we think of sometimes culture, but it's really the entire way of life. It's the ethos of a society, of a culture. Here's, I think I have time, yeah. I wanted to read a definition of culture. It says, the way of life of a particular people is shown in their ordinary behavior and habits, their attitudes towards each other, their own moral and religious beliefs, and then it's often described or shown by the life of a particular people through literature, art, music, dance, theater, etc. Now, here's an organizational development of culture, more from an organizational position. Broadly, social heritage of a group, an organized community or society, a pattern of responses discovered, developed, or invented during the group's history of handling problems, which arise from interactions amongst its members and between them and their environment. The responses are considered the correct way to perceive, feel, think, act, and are passed on to new members through immersion and teaching. So in other words, we're also talking about how we do things. What are the proper procedures and processes? How do we view certain things? What are our attitudes about many different elements? This is all part of a spiritual culture that we're developing more and more. And I think last year, the year before, I gave a talk here, and I was talking about some of the elements that we haven't really developed. I don't remember. I had a whole string there of things that we probably need to develop as we go on the next fit. We're talking about ISKCON in 100 years. I think Anuttam and I were doing that one. Right, Anuttam? Not Jim. He's nodding yes. Okay. You know, it's like with our next generations. Where do they fit in exactly? How much of the dominant, larger outside culture do they imbibe? How much of the Krishna conscious culture? What are our processes for, you know, integrating them and keeping, you know, in other words, we can think of so many questions that are really cultural questions. You know, and how do we develop these things? How do we celebrate within a family? How do you celebrate holidays? You know, it's a little thing. Well, why is that important? Because, you know, we don't have that so developed. We have festivals that we go to the temple, but what do you do in your home? Now, a lot of you are from Indian backgrounds. I know you still have a lot of different cultural things, right? Holidays and different things that people do. And those of us from maybe Judeo-Christian ethics, I mean, a lot of us, to be honest, we may do something at Christmas with our family. Why? Because these are all parts of culture that we learned and are deeply ingrained in ways that we do things, and we haven't really quite developed all the whole aspect of Vaishnava culture. Okay, so I'm going a little off topic here. But part of the culture is how we deal, work with each other, how we treat people. What is that ethos? What does that look like? For Vaishnavas, from everything that we've been hearing from the Bhagavatam, we obviously need a culture of love and care and service. These are sort of the foundational elements that we build everything else around. And much of that has to do with the way that we work with devotees and how we treat devotees. And this applies not just to leaders, is our topic today, but to all devotees, because we all have interaction with other devotees. And I would maintain that we often tolerate devotees. Sometimes we appreciate devotees. Sometimes we just stay out of their way. But really true care for another devotee is more rarely found, isn't it? You know, I mean, we all have practical human limitations. We can theoretically say, I love every living entity, but can you actually manifest that attitude towards every living entity? It's pretty difficult. It's a little more theoretical, isn't it? So, but devotees are right there. They are human beings that we can interact with. There's relationship. Where there's relationship, it's a little different. But those relationships aren't always perfect either. And so can we, you know, really manifest loving relationships with all devotees as we should? It's difficult. It's a challenge. But it needs to at least be there. We need to at least create an atmosphere so that love and service can come out, so that it can prosper and thrive. And of course, care means that we are being transcendental to attachment to the self, the self-interest, and what I need. And we are thinking more about being deeply concerned with the spiritual, emotional, and physical welfare of other devotees. Now, I want to take one step back here, but these are the caveats to what I've just said. And because someone will raise their hand and ask these things anyway, so I might as well address them. Don't leaders sometimes have to act decisively? Don't they have to sometimes do things that are unpleasant? Don't they have to sometimes not always be so loving, caring, and like this? And it's a legitimate question. Leaders often do have to act decisively, and they have to take strong action sometimes. And we have examples. What did Maharaj Parikkhit do when he came upon Kali beating the bull? Did he sit down and say, well, how are you feeling? You must be having a really hard day here, and you have some anger issues, it looks like, towards this bull. Did he do that? What did he do? Took his sword out, right? Ready to kill him. Because as a king, his duty was to enforce religious principles, including protection of the cow and bulls. Now, of course, there was a nice discussion, and he didn't kill him, and he actually ended up giving him shelter. But his first response was, this is my duty. You know, we saw in Srila Prabhupada's life, and as you hear so many of these memory tapes and stories about Prabhupada, often he chastised and corrected devotees, sometimes strongly. Prabhupada became angry with his disciples at times, not a lot, but he did. So what is the difference between an ordinary ruler who is making decisions and someone like Srila Prabhupada or Maharaj Parikkhit? What's the main difference? When Donald Trump fires somebody or when Maharaj Parikkhit is ready to chastise someone? Yeah. Push the right button. He knew what to do. It came from knowledge, from understanding. Yeah. And what about the attitude? What's the consciousness or attitude? What's the difference? Go ahead.
What is beneficial for the...
Say it loud.
What is beneficial for the person?
What is beneficial for the person? Absolutely. And that was Prabhupada's mentality. What does this person need? You know, like Shruti Kirti, who I work with in Hawaii, and we've been friends for many, many years, but we've become even closer lately. You know, he said to me that when he was with Prabhupada 2.5-3 years, he said, Prabhupada expressed anger or chastised him, he said, only once or twice. Because he said he knew I was, and he said, I saw him just, you know, give it to other people, but he never did to me. He said, because he knew I was, that wouldn't be good for me. I'd be too fragile, I'd be too hurt, you know, and I'd probably be crushed if Prabhupada chastised me. And Prabhupada knew that, so he never did it. You know, so as you were saying, the spiritual master's expert at knowing how to deal with different people. And also, he doesn't do it out of self-interest. He does it as his service. Sometimes a parent has to correct a child, right? Or even punish a child. Is the parent correcting or punishing the child out of anger or dislike or towards the child? Well, sometimes. Sometimes we become a little angry, we lose a little bit, right? But what are we going to say, Nichanda?
Depends on the parent.
Okay, but let's say a good parent. A good parent is operating out of love for the child, giving instruction out of love for that child's benefit so that they will learn properly. The spiritual master chastises so the disciple will learn properly. The king or the ruler may have to correct or chastise so that people learn, and also so that everything is going on well. So it's done from a service perspective. A leader does not act in self-interest, but on the service to guru, to ISKCON in our case, to one's family, or to one's community. So sometimes that, for the benefit of even sometimes of the greater good of the community, sometimes we have to act more decisively or strongly. So we may correct, challenge, if it's our service. I heard a devotee who goes around and preaches, does a lot of seminars lately, very, very nice devotee. He was asked this question in the Bhagavatam class, well, what about, you know, if you have, you know, what about criticism? What if criticism is deserved? You know, some people say we should never criticize, but what if someone's really doing something wrong? And his answer is real simple. If it's your service, then you do it. If it's not your service, why criticize? Or if it's nothing, if it's something that you don't have influence over, you know, or responsibility for. You know, it's like sometimes people ask me about, what do you think about this thing going on in the world? And just because, you know, my brain can only handle so much, I just have to say, I don't know, that's not my responsibility, it's not my service. I mean, I just respect those who are taking care of it. Let them take care of it. It's not my duty to criticize what's happening on the other side of the world. Well, unless it comes to a GBC meeting, then it is. If it becomes my service, then I do. I have to make a judgment. I have to do something. But if it's not, why pollute our minds, bother our minds, you know, distract our minds with criticism, you know, so many concerns that really aren't ours. Now, that doesn't mean we should be ignorant, you know, that we should not know things that are going on. Of course, devotees want to know things, you know. But again, we just need to be careful in what is best for our Krishna consciousness. So for a leader, it's a continual challenge. Because, and you have this in any organization. If you have, let's say you have a problem with a devotee. And there's two concerns, right? The best interest of the devotee and the best interest of the greater good of the community or the temple, whatever. A devotee may be doing something that's totally disruptive to the temple, so maybe they can't be there. But you really have two responsibilities. How to take care of the temple, how to do what's needed, you know, as your service to Srila Prabhupada, and at the same time, you also have a duty to that devotee to how to help them best spiritually. So we have to try to act as much as possible from a pure platform, and that requires spiritual strength. It requires sadhana, first of all. We have to have an honest self-examination. You know, it's important. We have to be always thinking about what is my motivation here? You know, what do I want? Am I acting? You know, and so sometimes I found the best thing in those cases just to pray deeply to Srila Prabhupada. You know, please help me. What would you want here? What is your desire? And of course, we don't always know that, how to, but yet we have the example. We have the mood of Srila Prabhupada. And, you know, and we have this idea that I am a servant. So how should I best do that service? Not what do I want, or I'm mad at this person, or I really, you know, I just want to get rid of this person or whatever. I've been in those situations lately, so I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, we need to really balance our concern and our love for these devotees of Krishna and what we need to do sort of for the greater good or the temple or community, whatever it might be. So that requires honest self-examination. I think we also need to have assessment and feedback from others. You know, sometimes there's resistance, but I think all of us need some type of assessment of how we're doing, or at least some process of feedback. We also need to take help from seniors, from mentors, or from friends. You know, sometimes if you're a very, very high senior, you don't have so many other seniors and mentors, you know, so who are going to instruct you, right? So hopefully you have friends that will tell you, you know, what you're doing wrong. Those of us who are householders have a built-in mechanism. It's called a wife, you know, who will kindly help instruct us, or, you know, if we're going off. But, you know, everybody needs somebody. You need a friend. You need someone who is going to say, well, Prabhu, I can see how you feel that way, but perhaps there's another way to look at it, or however it's done, or that was really stupid of you. I mean, you know, there's different ways it can be presented. But so we need to take help. We need instruction ourselves. And obviously we need to learn from the Bhagavatam, these great lessons from our acharyas, from these great devotees, and how they executed leadership. And what was their mood? What were the qualities they exhibited while they're doing that? So I think, Hare Krishna, are there other comments, questions, thoughts on this topic? I think we have a few minutes. Oh, hands are going out. Let's take Vaisheshika and then it's not Pran.
After you.
Or in the other order. You two can fight over the microphone, but yeah.
I really like the point you brought up about culture and how it is that we respond to people in tense situations, because that's when our real values get tested, when there's a lot of stress and you have to respond to somebody. I can't remember exactly what you said, but it had to do with the way in which we... can you read it again?
Yeah, let's see. Hopefully. Like the social heritage of a group.
It's the next one.
Those responses are considered the correct way to receive, feel, think, and act. Was it that?
No, next one.
Passed on to new members.
The one after that.
Culture determines what's acceptable or unacceptable, important, unimportant, right or wrong.
Nope.
Way of life of particular people, shown their behavior and habits, attitudes towards each other, the moral religious beliefs, art of describing, showing, performing. I don't know if I got it.
Maybe it's after that. It's a little after that.
Pattern of responses of a group's history, interactions among its members, response against correct by the ways we perceive, feel, think, and act. They're passed on to new members through immersion and teaching. Determines what's acceptable or unacceptable. I don't know. What are we missing?
Yeah, response. How the response. No, it's in the text. How we respond to.
Yeah, about our responses and interactions within.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was mentioned. Yeah. Why don't you go ahead with your point?
I just like to point.
Oh. Okay.
Just the. I think it's important to. We talk about culture and culture evolution. You brought that up also. To know what it is actually.
Yeah.
And those definitions.
Yeah.
Where obviously people thought about them a lot.
Because a lot of it has to do with human interaction, doesn't it? You know, how we relate to one another, how we respond.
How you respond to situations when there's it could go either way, and it's a real test. It's just like with an organization that has a mission statement. You know, when you have to make tough decisions, you have to come back and say, well, you know, let's look at the mission statement, see why we're doing this. And the culture of Vaishnavas, it's really important. Like there's this dichotomy between the mission and taking care of devotees.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do the devotees get ground up and put into the mortar and that's our culture? Or is it that you take care of devotees?
I think that's a great point. Because sometimes it does seem like a dichotomy. You know, I was thinking about, I had it recently, last year somewhere, I was getting inaugurated somewhere, and I was asked to do a seminar or a talk on the seven principles of ISKCON and the mission, Prabhupada's mission. And it's interesting because if you really analyze those, about half of them are about outreach, preaching, book distribution, you know, and about half of them are about devotee care. and how we relate to one another, creating a place, you know, a place for devotees to come together. So those two aspects, I think, were there right from the beginning with Srila Prabhupada. And we saw in his behavior, too, that Srila Prabhupada showed great concern, care, love for the devotees, and at the same time, he pushed the devotees to the mission, to preach.
Yeah. And your point about our interpersonal dealings with devotees, is it necessary, is it your duty to criticize, or if it's not, then you don't do it? That's a part of culture.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference.
Yeah, these are cultural elements. They're the sort of part of the norms, the mores, the ethos, you know, that we develop. And, you know, they say that in changing organizations, it's hardest to change culture because culture is very embedded. Now, I would say that in ISKCON, we have certain embedded elements of culture, but because we're not so established, there's a little bit of fluidity possible, you know, and we can work to establish the best elements of culture that we think should be there in the ideal.
Just one last point about culture, and then I'm handing it over to Nanda Pran. But Joseph T. O'Connell, the preeminent scholar of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, who passed away recently, he also wrote the foreword for the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, was a great friend of the devotees.
O'Connell?
Writes that he gave his definition of culture as that which is real, right, and valuable. And then he defined an institution as the means through which one transports culture across time and geography. And that gives an idea that we're actually, the reason we maintain an institution is to transport the culture. So
absolutely.
You have to know what the culture is and define what the culture is carefully.
That was wonderfully put. I hope everybody heard that. I really like that. And maybe I can talk to you more about that or get that down or get those quotes from O'Connell, because I think that really does describe, you know, because you're really talking about a real set of values, and then how do those values get passed down through generations, and how do they horizontally permeate the organization and the society? Thank you. Great. Nityananda Prabhu.
Thank you, Tamar Prabhu. I mean, the verse that you picked and the different facets or the spectrum of a devotee or a leader's character, the way you described, was really very inspiring and educational. The question I have is, what place does, along with character, what place does competency have?
Okay, you said besides character, what is the place of competency?
Yeah, because right now most of the aspects you covered were of character, you know, but we do find that as much is needed is character and competency.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the devotee may be very well-intentioned, good character, but if it is not competent enough...
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. The question is basically, where's the element of competency? How does that fit in with leadership? Like, we all know devotees who are wonderful devotees. They have wonderful character. They're sadhus. But if someone said, should he be a temple president or GBA leader, everyone would kind of laugh and go, no, that's not, that wouldn't be, yeah, it wouldn't work. Or, because, you know, we have qualities, you know, we have, you know, not that we're stuck in a varna or an ashram particularly, but we do have different propensities. And people do need to be engaged according to their propensities, and some people have that propensity more for management or leadership than others for those kind of positions. And at the same time, I would say that if a person has, you know, a few basic qualities and has the other good character qualities, they can learn. There's a certain amount of a person is willing to learn. They can learn principles. They can become more competent, you know, by learning principles of management leadership. You went to business school, I'm sure, or you went to management school. So you learn some of these things, right? There are certain principles of how you run a business or how you manage people or whatever that are learned. Otherwise, they wouldn't have programs and courses and degrees in these things. You know, so there's this idea, there is a certain element there, but probably you have to begin at least with some basic propensity, I would say. And then, I'd say then beyond that, as we talked about in the beginning of the class, the idea that we are all leaders in some sphere or another. You know, is that okay, or do you have more thoughts on it? This is kind of fun watching them fight over giving each other the microphone.
One thought I had was, in watching how Prabhupada picked leaders, for instance, on the first GBCs, he tended to towards those who had distinguished themselves by preaching.
Yeah.
And that some of them didn't have the same kind of character as others. I mean, there were some rough characters there, but because they distinguished themselves by preaching, he noted them. And I think yeah. that's an interesting point, part of which is because, those who engage in preaching and have good sadhana tend to develop good qualities also and some kind of competency. But he also saw that if you were up for preaching, expanding the Krishna consciousness movement, he appreciated that kind of competency.
Absolutely.
Competency especially.
He did, and I would contend that Prabhupada valued both, character and competency, but it was also the beginning of our movement, the pioneering phase, and someone who was willing, who had the ability, to go out and to preach, to establish Krishna consciousness was very valuable and very much needed. It was absolutely needed at that time in the pioneering phase of Krishna consciousness, and Prabhupada knew that. Prabhupada knew how to engage people according to time, place, and circumstance.
I was just thinking that the awareness of the importance of spreading Krishna consciousness is a value unto itself.
Yeah.
And that's especially important in leaders in the Krishna consciousness movement, since our ultimate purpose, as Prabhupada writes in the Adi Lila, is to unlimitedly expand the preaching. And therefore, we could find somebody with great competency but lacks the spirit of preaching. For mm-hmm. instance, someone who might disparage book distribution or other kinds of preaching because, hey, it's like that was for another time, or it's too much over the top, or whatever it might be, and then enlist somebody who's highly competent materially to manage. And how would you feel about that?
Well, I think that I began this with almost an assumption, which I should have articulated, an assumption that the leader is, and obviously to be a leader, you have to be a follower, to be a servant. But first, that means being a servant of your guru, being a follower of your guru. So if you're not following Srila Prabhupada, then, it's almost like it's off the table. You're not a leader. And following Srila Prabhupada means three things. We want to understand the instructions of the guru. We want to understand the mood of the guru, and we want to understand the example of the guru. So if we look at Prabhupada's instructions, we look at Prabhupada's example, and we look at his mood, that's what we want to be aware of. And if you're not very committed to the whole concept, at least theoretically, of preaching, of outreach, of giving Krishna consciousness to others, distributing books, then you really haven't understood Prabhupada. You really haven't. Because that was Prabhupada's mood. And those of us who were there and remember it when Prabhupada was with us, it was not just something Prabhupada occasionally talked about. You've written a whole book about Srila Prabhupada's mood about books and preaching, right? No, wasn't it kind of a constant theme, not an occasional theme, would you say? Yeah, that's what Prabhupada talked about, writing his books, translating, printing, distributing his books. It was probably, if you looked at all the things he did, and you could look at schools, farms, temples, for all of us, our understanding, when we were with Srila Prabhupada, that probably if you put all those, number one would be books. It was Prabhupada's number one emphasis of getting spiritual literature out to the masses of people. There's no way around that. So, yes, a leader has to understand the mood of his guru. Okay, and other people? I think we've got a few minutes, Matt. Okay. Cool.
Thank you, Tomo Harpabu. My question is, when you explain in the qualities of the leader and in terms of facilitating and serving the devotees and caring for the devotees, for those who are under your leadership. Now, in the structure of the institution, we have so many layers of leaders mm-hmm. that obviously they may have different understandings of how to care and facilitate.
Yeah.
And you have it all the way, from top to down. still within the purview of caring and following, you know, Srila Prabhupada's.
That should be there on all those layers. Yeah.
Yeah. However, there is differences, even you know, of and we see that in so many ways in our institution, in the temples, in the departments, etc., etc. What's your realization of how this could be, you know, sort of coming into the center and then being, you know, on one voice?
Yeah, I guess what you're saying is there's many layers of leadership. You know, there should be this move, but we see a lot of differences, and people have different perspectives or different ways that they act and deal with each other. I think one of the answers there is training and learning. And I think we need to have more leadership training around these principles. Nitya Prabhu also gives a leadership course. We've established this GBC College. It's like several weeks of training in India for those who are going to be zonal supervisors, future GBCs, very intense coursework. And part of that is not just about, you know, being able to do the counting, you know, but how do we work with and inspire devotees properly? And I think that what we're seeing is more and more of those elements coming into the different, you know, training venues and opportunities that we have within ISKCON, which still isn't fully manifest, which needs to be more developed. And that's kind of like our next step, is to take some of this leadership training and really get it out there and spread it, you know, so that temple presidents, temple managers, you know, it's available, that we really have that. And I think that a very, very large component is this, is just the whole thing about relationships and the whole thing about influence and the whole thing about inspiration, you know, how we really work with devotees to inspire them to bring out the best. That's what leadership is, you know. And I think kind of a little bit behind, you were saying it very nicely, but there may have been some, got a little implication that maybe our leaders aren't always quite up to this position. And I'd say, yeah, but you know, it's like, devotees are doing the best they can, and we probably all need more training. We need to talk about these things. We need to, you know, we need training in these things.
Since I was, you know, thinking that not necessarily that you have an unqualified leader, but rather it's just a different approach, and sometimes they, you know, it doesn't, you have different things happening, you know.
Yeah, it's not all one. It's not like, you know, here's one model of a leader and they all act this way and they all talk this way. No, we're individuals, we have different personalities, we have different perspectives. You know, some people are very effective with, you know, certain ways that they do things, you know, like, you know, there are different approaches, sure. I guess what I was trying to emphasize here was more the underlying attitude, the underlying consciousness of the leader, and he may manifest that differently according to their own personality, etc. Yeah. Okay, anything else? We're almost out of time. One more.
Hare Krishna. A comment on inspirational leadership and an example. Yesterday at the end of our GBC meeting, by the inspiration of Rompad Maharaj and Bir Krishan Maharaj, they kind of swept us out the door onto the street to do book distribution for an hour, and set the example. And it was filmed, and then it just, and all the leaders that were in the room went out, and I saw dozens of comments from people, because it was on Facebook, from all over the world, appreciating the fact that action speaks louder than words, and they were very inspired by it. Okay. So we thank those leaders for inspiring us. Hare Krishna.
Thank you. Yes, and Vaisheshika is constantly inspiring us in this direction. Yeah. Okay, we should end now. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.